Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, I guess it's no secret by now that on American Variety, we're partial to adventurers and to people who care about the planet's natural environment, and many of our guests are authors. So maybe it's not surprising if a guest on the show is someone who is all three. Bill Belville is an author and a naturalist and a filmmaker and a diver and explorer of old Florida, which really means, I guess nowadays, disappearing Florida, and in particular, he's fascinated with water in its natural state. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Court. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you on. This is actually the third time that Bill has been a guest on American Variety. We first had him on several years ago talking about his book, River of Lakes, The Journey on Florida's St. John's River, which is a very unusual river in Florida. It's very large, probably the largest river in North Florida, and it flows north, which is unusual for rivers to do. So he explored that thoroughly in its history and, you know, the geology and geography of it. Then a few years ago, with another book, he was back talking about Salvaging the Real Florida, Lost and Found in the State of Dreams, which is, you know, again, kind of a deep dive into the old Florida and how it's threatened by all of the massive changes that assault it all the time over the decades with tourists and retirement and development and so on, like happens many places, but it happens in a different way and maybe more intensely in Florida. So today, we're talking about Bill's latest book called The Peace of Blue, Water Journeys. Now, that's spelled P-E-A-C-E, so the Peace of Blue. And like Bill's other books, this is a collection of nonfiction essays, and actually there are nearly 30 of them in all. And a lot of it involves travel in one way or another, but it's not a travel guide. And like the other books, all of the chapters deal with water in some form, both salt and fresh. But unlike the other books, it ranges not only throughout Florida, but all around the Caribbean. And it's very informative about the natural history and flora and fauna of the areas he visits. All of his books are not scholarly. They're not scholarly at all. They're very readable. And in fact, Bill's writing is, I would call it lyrical, almost poetic in many places. And he's passionate about his subject, and it definitely comes through in his books. So, Bill Belville, you're clearly in love with natural Florida, and especially the water that surrounds it in every direction, including the aquifers beneath its surface. How did you acquire that powerful affinity and attraction for water?
Well, I think that's a fair thing to say. I am in love with natural Florida. As a young boy, I did not grow up in Florida, but I did grow up on the peninsula on the eastern shore of Maryland. That peninsula was isolated by the Chesapeake Bay, and at that time, the accessibility to that peninsula was very limited by outsiders. They had to take car ferries to get over. So as a result, we had a very much of an intact natural landscape there that was veined with water, and it defined what we did in so many ways. We didn't have the range of TV, we didn't have a lot of technology, so we went outside a lot and we bonded with what the place was about. And as we did, you know, I began to have this real strong feeling for water and just how it affected our lives. After church on Sunday, my mom and dad and my brother and I would go out and go to a local tidal river and go fishing or go crabbing. After college, when I came to Florida to visit to look for some work, I was struck with how much of that feeling sort of was still evoked, was still inside of me. And I've been spending all that time since I've been in Florida over the last 38 to 40 years really trying to explore these various natural systems.
Yeah, I think, you know, I grew up on the edge of Miami, which is back then on the edge of the Everglades, and I used to explore the edge of the Everglades myself as a little kid, you know, and just like you say, we spent more time outdoors and our parents gave us more freedom in that regard. And boy, I was fascinated with the wildlife and the plant life and, you know, I guess water everywhere, it's a universal thing. You know, water just supports so much more diversity of appearance of nature and the reality of nature than in some flat cornfield in Nebraska would or something. And it's so, you know, it just grabs you and holds you lifelong. Well, I mentioned the style of your writing. It's very much like prose poems almost and lyrical. Could you maybe pick a passage and just read a sampling for us?
Sure, yeah. And as you mentioned, the book is devoted to Florida, but also to parts of the Caribbean. And really, the Caribbean is a bioregion of Florida, or Florida is a bioregion of the Caribbean, depending on how you look at that. I'll start off with one here that takes place not too far from where I live. It's entitled ALF, the Sacred River, What Will Become of It? And I'd lead that. I'd take an excerpt from Elizabeth Bishop, a very fine poet, who said, "The state with the prettiest name, the state that floats in brackish water, held together by mangrove roots." So Ms. Bishop got it right. She got it right then, and held together on mangrove roots, and here we are. And so here's the story, which could be called narrative essays, because that's indeed what they really are. I'm somewhere inside the vortex of Blue Spring, way past the prevent your death, go no farther sign at 60 feet, and far beyond the muted glow of surface light. The river that Blue feeds has been gradually warming, and the warm-blooded manatees who overwinter here have just left. Except for a few snorkelers back up in the shallow run, my dive buddy and I are alone in the spring. The only illumination down here is portable, handheld, and like the trail of exhaust bubbles from a regulator, it tethers me to the surface with my own limitations. Scuba tanks, face masks, containers of light, they're all reminders of how unsuited we humans are to immerse ourselves in the most primal and universal element of all. Here, near the 120-foot deep bottom of this limestone chasm, I am aware as I have ever been of the pervasive power in magic of water. All but invisible, it arises from a dark slot in the rock, flailing me like a rag doll with its energy.
Yeah, so that would be a very unusual place for a human to be, 120 feet down next to a big vent out of which is exploding ancient water from an aquifer at a very high rate, and you're flailing around, as you say, like a rag doll. You know, the different chapters in the book describe many explorations like that and some real adventures in places far off the beaten track. In a river in Panama is one, and off the coast of Cuba, and on small Caribbean islands whose names I've never heard of, and in swamps, and as you just described, in underground springs like the Blue Spring in Florida. And so, what are, you know, if you had to pick like some, you know, probably that kind of experience as a peak experience, what are a couple more really memorable experiences that you've had in pursuit of this passion you have for water and the peace of blue?
Well, quite a few of them take place here in Florida, which even though we're called the Sunshine State, probably ought to be called the Water State. I mean, we have this wonderful coastline. We've got over 1,000 springs. We have 800 lakes, 50 very nonlinear miles of river. So we're given to water, and there's lots of places here that allow you the opportunity to explore. And despite the fact that Florida is so regarded by many folks as known and domesticated, they don't always educate themselves to the fact that this resources, these very magical places, are still there. And thankfully, despite the problems that we have had with politics in Florida, that over the last 20, 25 years, Floridians have made a very strong attempt to preserve a lot of places that are very special to them by having the government buy it and keeping it as public land, parks, preserves, state forest, and so on. So, you know, we have that opportunity here, and you can go out to some of these places, and you go by yourself or you go with a friend, and you can have an experience that somebody may have had in that same place 500 years ago or even more. And that's what I really like about Florida, the fact that these places do exist. In fact, I can drive 20 minutes from where I live and go out to the Wakaba River Basin, where there is 110 square miles of land around that basin, around that Springhead River, and I can have an experience there that is it'll put me in a wild place, as wild as any place that I've been before. Black bears, alligators, and all that stuff that's there, and fascinating more than scary to me, but it's part of the larger gestalt of the experience, where you simply go, whether you're paddling in a kayak, whether you're diving in the spring, or you're simply hunting for small springs, which is something else I like to do, you're still giving yourself an opportunity to have an experience in the wild.
Yeah, people have heard, obviously, of Silver Spring, but and a few of the biggest ones maybe, but really, Florida, as you say, is dotted with springs, both large and medium and small. And, you know, they're different from the springs that come out of a rock on the side of a mountain further north in mountainous areas. I mean, some of them are like that, too. But basically, a lot of them are just upwellings out of the aquifer. Let's talk for a minute about the water cycle and the geology that produces these big upwellings of pure water out of the ground.
Well, Florida does, of course, have springs that come out of the aquifer. And because Florida is newer in a geological sense, we have this limestone under much of the surface called karst, which is a younger limestone. And it's formed by the sedimentation of sand and coral and bones and ground-up invertebrates, sometimes whole invertebrates. Sometimes you can make out a sand dollar in the wall of a cave. The water is cutting its way through. So we have a lot of this in Florida. We have that karst topography, but we also have, left over from our days when we were under the sea, we have a lot of high areas, higher shoals, that are usually scrub or sandhill. And by high, I mean maybe 70 to 100 feet below the water level. And that's not high by standards elsewhere, but in Florida, that's pretty daggone high. And a lot of these places, these are prime recharge areas for our springs themselves. So rainwater will come down. It'll seep down through the porous sand. It'll hit that very soft karst. And because that rainwater is slightly acidic from percolating through the soil and everything, it will gradually cut its own little pathway through a fissure that might happen to be there. It might enlarge that fissure over time, and maybe in a lifetime, maybe an inch or two, a human lifetime, but water has a lot longer lifetime to work with. So we have the great benefit of these recharge, high recharge areas. We have the benefit of this soft sponge-like rock, and the hydrostatic pressure of all that water above the water that's pushing its way through the rock will push it, will continue to push it until in a lower area, you know, driven by gravity, it will find a fracture that can actually be breached, and it will breach it and become a spring. And when it does, it will flow big. It may flow as large as our first magnitude springs, 64 million gallons of water more a day, or it may be a third or fourth or fifth magnitude spring, which is a lot less than all that. But nonetheless, it flows, and it seems to flow in a way that other springs that are back on the continent don't seem to flow. And the other part of that is we were just now learning truly how many springs that we have here in Florida. 10 years ago, my partner and I, working on a film project, did a film, a PBS film, on the Wakaba River nearby. In that time, there were believed to be 20 springs. Now there are known to be 35. That's only 10 years. So in this day and age, with all the modern hustle and bustle of Florida, we're still discovering new things about our springs. We're discovering new things about the animals that live inside the springs, that live inside the caves, many of which are endemic to those places. They don't live anywhere else in the entire world. And we just recently learned that these albino crayfish that you'll see living back in the dark, deep inside of a spring, deep inside of a cave, they can live to be up to 200 years old. So there's lots of fascinating information that's still being discovered all the time. And we're blessed, really, to have this abundance of springs and everything that goes along with it.
Yeah, and I think the water that emerges from a big spring, really super clear water, it almost looks like air, is not just recently recycled rainwater. It's the process you described is very slow, and the water coming out can be thousands of years old, right? I mean, it's the first time it's been above ground for thousands of years.
Well, it can be, and it is. The water management districts will measure the age of the water, and a lot of times there is mixing involved. There will be some more recent water that comes down that mixes with older water that's deeper in the aquifer, and so you don't really get any one particular conduit full of one particular age of water. You usually do get a mix, and it may be anywhere from 80 years to 1,000 years old, depending on how the how the spring is situated itself.
Okay.
So again, more of the fascination in terms of we're just now learning about these magical places, and we probably ought to slow down before we do too many things to affect them in a negative way. We probably ought to learn more about them, and then we can be better stewards of them.
Well, I think there's also one aspect of the process that, you know, produces the sinkholes that we see in the news fairly often, where suddenly this giant rupture will appear on the surface and swallow a house or something, and so why don't you talk just very briefly about the mechanics of how sinkholes appear with respect to the water in the aquifer?
If you sort of pull back and you look at Florida from sort of a cutaway version, if you could slice it and look underneath it, you would see caves underneath much of Florida, and they would be full of water. and that water would be flowing at different rates. And the closer you get to the surface, the caves in that area, if they do lose their flow for whatever reason, such as the place where they normally are recharged by rainfall, if that place is paved over, if it's taken out of the equation in any sort of way, or if there's too much water pumped from that spring shed or from that spring, the caves themselves where the springs flow through will begin to collapse because of the sheer weight of the earth overhead. And it happens in strange and bizarre ways. I think one of the most recent ones, you know, not terribly long ago, was a poor guy was in his bed in his bedroom, and a sinkhole opened, but only under his bedroom, and he and his bed and everything went down into it and were never recovered afterwards.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with author Bill Belville, who has written his latest book called The Peace of Blue Water Journeys. And we're talking with him about, partly about Florida, but really about water in general, both salt and fresh, and his explorations around the Caribbean Basin, exploring the many ways that water, the forms that water takes in nature and its status nowadays, which changes all the time with our impact on it, right? So, you know, Bill, as a third-generation Floridian myself, I was surprised in reading your book at how new Florida is geologically. I knew it was once all undersea, but I didn't realize it had emerged from the sea so recently. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that's true, Court, and that is part of the equation that keeps this geology young, because it is relatively new. And while 5 to 20 million years ago may seem like a long time to us, for a spring to be soaring through, flowing through limestone that is that old, that's a relatively new occurrence, because other limestone areas overseas and back on the continent up north, that limestone could be 200-300 million years old. So compared to limestone that's, 5, 20, maybe 40 or 50 million years, that's a relatively young limestone. And while it looks hard on the surface, the fact that it is younger, that it is softer, that it can be carved through the flow of water, that it would be slightly acidic, that does provide a whole new dimension on what Florida is about. Because these springs, they not only are magical and not only are just breathtaking places to be, whether you're a diver or a paddler or somebody who just wants to stand on the shore and appreciate them, but they also come out of our Florida aquifer, which is a major source of drinking water. It provides 90% of our drinking water for Floridians.
Well, Florida is a very long state, right? It's about 400 miles from Key West to up at the Georgia line, and it really it's only tropical in the southern part, South Florida. So central and north Florida transition into the temperate zone, more like Georgia and the Carolinas and so on. They become almost, more mid-Atlantic. So it's very different in the very northern part and the very southern part. Do you relate to both those worlds equally? And what are the main things about each that appeal to you most?
Well, I do, Court, and that's a good question, because the way I don't see Florida as being distinctly one place or another when I'm out to have fun, to explore, to do whatever it is I'm doing out in nature, because I see it more as a whole. And we have warm temperate on the St. John's River, for instance. Here's a river that comes to life not far from Lake Okeechobee down in the Glades, flows for 310 miles, and then flows north, and then comes out to sea east of Jacksonville. So while the upper reaches of that particular river might be more subtropical because they're warmer, the lower reaches would be warm temperate. So it's still the same river. And the river has different characteristics based on where it is and what types of terrain it flows through. So I don't really make a point to try to say this is temperate, this is not, because it's the great biological diversity of Florida. And I'm everything I've read, particularly things that are very well informed by people like E.O. Wilson, everything I read tells me that Florida is one of the most biologically diverse states that we have because of this. It is a peninsula. It's not just a place. We're surrounded by water. We're underpinned by water. We have water flowing everywhere. So it takes the standard definition of temperate and subtropic, and it kind of turns it on its head, because it's that mix of temperate and subtropic that have really helped define Florida. And sure, you can go to the Panhandle and it'll be colder up there than it would be down in Sanford or certainly in Miami, but that's, you know, it still does not remove those parts of Florida from the larger equation. It's, again, it's part of this gestalt from the get-go that has really defined the biological diversity of both plants and animals. And that rate really soars here. We do have an awful lot of different kinds of plants and different kinds of animals. It's almost like a staging ground to see what works and what doesn't. Hmm. You know? So I have a lot of fun, and so do other folks that are curious about nature and have a strong affinity for it, a strong connection with it.
And obviously, water is essential to life everywhere. But is Florida, being a peninsula, and as you say, surrounded by water and floating on water, so to speak, is it more dependent on water than other areas of the country are in some ways? More dependent?
Well, we all need water. We need water to live as humans. The big difference is back on the continent, again, most of the water that people consume comes from surface areas, rivers that maybe have dammed and then turned into reservoirs. And the big difference, and it is a very big one, most of our water here, as I mentioned, 90% of our water that's potable, that comes out of our faucet, comes from our aquifer. So it comes from below the ground rather than above the ground. So it's not like we need it any more than anybody else. It's just that it comes to us in a different way. Mm-hmm. And we should be aware of the fact that it does. And by being aware, we can be more vigilant about sustaining those conditions in which it does thrive, which it allows us as living beings to thrive as well.
So knowing that we should be aware about it and doing anything about it are two different things. I mean, we hear about the water wars out west and of course, the long-running drought in the west, and it's a critical fact of life that's right in everybody's face there. Does the same kind of extreme situation exist nowadays in Florida as far as water goes? Is it as visible and political as it is other parts of the country yet?
Well, yes, unfortunately it is, and it may be even more pronounced at this particular time in the existence of Florida because our springs now are under siege. This is a state where we have an awful lot of people, almost 20 million people living here. And back in the 1950s, when Marjorie Kennan Rollins and other people were here, there were 2 million people in the state. And because growth has really driven our economy here, the folks that allow that growth to happen, as government officials and politically elected government officials, haven't always looked towards the long-term sustainability of the landscape. They just simply allow people to come in and settle where they need to settle, maybe within a planning and zoning restrictions, but these are restrictions that have less to do with resources and more to do with some sort of bureaucratic preference than anything else. So, yeah, we're having a tough time right now because our springs are diminishing, and they have gradually been over the last several years because we haven't really acknowledged the spring sheds. We haven't acknowledged how these springs do come to life. And so the spring sheds are not protected in most cases. And you have water coming out of a spring, and the late cave diver and very insightful and caring man, Wes Skiles, who was one of the first to tell me years ago, helped me understand that when the state buys a spring, the actual spring itself, to put it in the middle of a state park, all they're buying is a hole in the ground. If they don't protect all that spring shed area, and that might be 100 square miles, 200 square miles, if they do nothing to protect that, then you simply have a hole in the ground with water flowing. And one day, if you're not careful, you just may simply have a hole in the ground. So that's what we're looking at right now. We're looking at the fact that the spring that was once considered the largest spring in the entire world, Silver Springs, it has lost half of its flow since the 1950s. And Dr. Robert Knight, who runs the Florida Springs Institute and has been studying that spring and others for a long time, now tells us that if that trend continues, within 15 years, Silver Spring will no longer flow.
Wow.
And that's adding to other springs as well, but because Silver does have the name recognition, folks are really beginning to wonder, like, well, what's going on? What should I do? And so folks who care and folks who know in a scientific way about these things are trying to help others understand, if we let these we're not just losing the magic. I mean, that's a big thing, certainly, and it fires the imagination of poets, and I think it's important to a lot of us. But we're losing our economy. And the great irony is when politicians say, oh, well, we need to develop this springshed because we need jobs. Well, the great irony is, hey, man, if you have no water flowing out of your faucet, what's that going to do to your job?
Hey, we just have a minute or so left. I mentioned you're a filmmaker, and you mentioned a film you had done. So just tell us very briefly about a couple of your past projects, but and more particularly, I think you have a current project in the works. So why don't you talk about that just in a minute or so?
Sure. Well, the current project is called Hidden Secrets of Florida Springs. It's a PBS documentary, and Hidden Secrets has two meanings. One, we'll help people understand just how complex the springs are. As I was explaining, the springs can support just a very diverse but not very well-known array of animals and fossils and things like that. But they also, they're very, very vulnerable and far more so than most of us know. And because they're under siege right now, you know, we have these places that, you know, that are have this wonderful secrets they have held for a long time and to our benefit. Now the big secret is, guess what, guys? We're running out of the water that flows out of their springs. And if we don't do something really quick, that's going to happen. So we're hoping to first help people understand how springs were formed and how all the really wonderful, intricate ecological aspects of springs are just so fascinating. We'll talk a bit about culture, how springs have influenced culture here in Florida over time, which to a lot of people may be new information, you know, to know how writers and artists and musicians have been influenced by springs. So we'll help folks understand how springs have really influenced our culture, and that might be a hidden secret in some way. But again, the biggest hidden secret is the fact that despite all this, the richness, the mystery, the magical nature of springs, we're on the verge of losing them under our watch. We need to do something pretty quick about that, or if they go away, then it won't be the same for us.
Like the Joni Mitchell song says, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. So, and unfortunately, yeah, that's too often true, and there's nothing you can do about it once it's gone in many cases. But I tell you what, to learn more about it, this is obviously something we'd like to talk about longer here on American Variety, but we are out of time. You can go, though, to a couple of websites that Bill has that are very informative and where you can see photos and I think a little video trailer maybe and that kind of thing. So one is BillBellville.com. I'll spell, you know, Bill, B-I-L-L, B-E-L-L-E, V-I-L-L-E.com, BillBellville.com. And another one, EquinoxDocumentaries.org. So that's E-Q-U-I-N-O-X, Documentaries.org. And that's where he focuses more on his filmmaking. Bill, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety to talk about water.
You're very welcome, Court. Thank you for wanting to do this program.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.